Folk session number 13273, reel 4.
Mr. Spooner, reel 4.
David Beatty, so he was the co-pilot who I promoted and became my right-hand man in the end, and who post-war became a very well-known author. He summed it up better than anybody else in one sentence, one short sentence. He said, Malta was totally unreal. And that does sum it up.
What did you think of the Maltese civilians under the siege?
Frankly, we saw very little of them, because they were almost entirely living like troglodytes in the shelters. I saw very, very little of them, apart from barman and the odd mess man, the mess steward. I frankly didn't see them. But I realise now that they were a wonderful bunch of people, because a security was almost non-existent, and there was never any place more open to sabotage. And as far as I know, we were never sabotaged. And it was not their war. It was our war, not their war. Yet once the Italians started to bomb them, that was their fatal mistake, once the Italians started to bomb them, they were as determined as we were to succeed. Bombing of civilians is entirely non-productive.
Did you feel that the island deserved the George Cross Medal?
Completely. I feel that, well, as you may or may not know, I'm very active in a thing called the George Cross Island Association now, and I joined this thing about 4 or 5. I'm vice president, and the thing I fought for almost from the day I joined was to get a medal for everybody who was in Malta. And at first we tackled the British government, also tackled Prince Philip, who I happen to know, and I once met Margaret Thatcher's husband on a golf course, and I tackled Dennis too. We tackled everybody in Britain about this Malta medal, and the answer was always too late. No one said it was undeserved. But anyhow, the association went on tackling everybody to get the Malta medal, and last year the Malta government gave it. And the Queen, God bless her, gave permission, and quite uniquely, I think it is, for the Malta medal to be worn as if a British medal. It's a foreign decoration, and it's worn completely online as it was a British decoration. I think that's unique.
How did you come to leave the island?
Well, I go back a bit. One of the things which kept us going on the island, Hugh Pugh, in my opinion, Hugh Pugh Lloyd saved that island. He was head and shoulders above anybody else who saved that island, Hugh Pugh Lloyd, the AOC. One of the things which he did, which kept the island going, was the steel aircraft. You see, there was no aircraft then, fortunately for Malta, which had the range to fly from Gibraltar to the Middle East. So they all had to arrive in Malta to refuel. It's about a 10-hour flight in the Wellington, or 9-hour flight in the Wellington from Gibraltar to Malta, where you night stopped if you were in transit the Middle East, and then you went on the Middle East next night. An awful lot of those aircraft stayed in Malta. He was known, I think, in the RAF as Sticky Fingers Lloyd. And that's what kept us going. He stole aircraft. I had permission from Hugh Pugh Lloyd to steal any aircraft I wanted, and I stole several. Luckily, my old squadron, 221, was being moved from Iceland, where it was, by various stages, to Middle East. And these were the only ASV Wellingtons in existence. Sheer luck, they're being moved to the Middle East. And of course, when the bombing began, I was losing aircraft on the ground all the time. So as 221 squadrons came through, I used to steal their aircraft.
How did you do it?
Well, just took it.
You just climbed in and flew it away?
Yeah, sometimes the same night.
Where to?
Where did
you fly the airplanes to?
Well, just on operations. If there was a convoy to find that night, or next night, but we just seized the aircraft. But you asked me how I left the island, but this is why I have digressed. Hugh Pugh sent for me one night and said, "Spooner," he said, "you've had it." And he was amazing. He was an AOC, and I'd say I was I was a pilot officer when I arrived there, and I don't say he called me by my first name, but, you know, he was a friend by then. He used to put an arm around my shoulder sometimes. We once had an amazing climb up a vertical ladder together, but that's another story. And, you know, he sort of sent me one night and said, "Spooner, you've had it." He said, "All your aircraft have been destroyed now, I can't see any more coming through for some time." And he said, "You're a mess." I got in Patigo, and almost seemed to be the only medical thing they had left on the island seemed to be this violet gentian stuff. And my face was dabbled with with violet gentian. I had this carbuncle on the back of my neck, and he said, "You've had it." He said, "There's a bomber command Wellington coming through tonight on the way to Middle East." He said, "Take your crew." He said, "Take Beatty and his crew and fly yourselves to Egypt." So he even lent me his car, AOC. He lent me his car and chauffeur so I could say goodbye to some Maltese friends I had that night. And he said, "Well, who do you want to take over?" I said, "Well, there's a chap, one of the chaps whose aircraft we'd stolen." I said, "Well, he's a rebel. He's put up a great number of blacks in England. I think he might do well here." So he said, "That's fine. I'll put him in charge. I won't tell you who he is because he was a rebel." And so this bomber command Wellington arrived, and the night as they did arrive, and I think it was being flown by a sergeant pilot. No, I think it was a pilot officer, I think. A pilot officer was flying it. He was very surprised being met by a flight lieutenant with a car. And I said, "I've come to meet you. I've come to take you to your quarters." He said, "That's very kind of you, sir." I said, "Make sure that you get everything out." He said, "Well," he said, "but I won't bother," he said, "because we're off tomorrow night." I said, "Get everything out." I said, "You can't trust the Maltese. They'll steal anything." I said, "Make sure you get every single thing out, otherwise there won't be a thing left in the morning." So he said, "Yes, get everything out, all personal belongings and everything else." So he says, "Okay." And I said, "I'll drive you to your quarters." He said, "That's very kind of you, sir." And I drove him to his quarters, of course, and picked up Beatty and his crew and my crew, you see, and about an hour we were on our way to Egypt. And of course he woke up next morning along with scores of others, and wondered what had happened to his aircraft.
So did your health recover quickly once you got out of the island?
Oh, yes. And you know, one is young and one does recover. There was no rationing, nothing in Egypt, absolutely nothing to do. I mean, we sat in the transit camp for about 6 weeks at Al Marza, doing absolutely nothing. And we weren't allowed out till noon or something in case our postings. After that, we were left on our own. And it's all the food and everything else you wanted in Egypt. All the food, all the booze, everything.
Now, at the end of the war, later in the war, with 53 Squadron, you went back to U-boat to work. Mm. Had it changed much then?
It was completely unrecognizable, nearly. In the first place, we had a war-winning aircraft, the B-24 Liberator, a magnificent aircraft with enormous range. Four very reliable Pratt & Whitney radial engines, which almost never failed, enormous range, and a superb radar. We now had a PPI, if you know what a PPI is, a planned position indicator, and now there was no question of juggling around with blips on lines, and we had a complete circular plot, and if we found something, and this radar could find U-boats in the Atlantic, it showed you where it was relative to the aircraft position, and we had far better depth charges. Originally we had an old naval depth charge full of TNT. Now we had a much more powerful explosive called Torpex, and we had a bomb sight, which we never had before. We had a low-level bomb sight. We only bombed by eye before. It's a comfortable aircraft. It had a nice seat to sit in instead of sitting on your parachute for about 12 hours, which gave you piles, of course. A large crew, about 10. We were armed to the teeth, although I often wonder why, because we very seldom met anything. We were armed to the teeth with American .5 guns and 303s. We had a well-trained crew who all knew their stuff. They'd all been years and years being trained. They finished their training at Nassau in the Bahamas, and the training captain, who'd been training with the crew in the Nassau for a long period, came in as co-pilot. So you had a very experienced co-pilot who had been captain of the training crew, and also a 53 squadron happened to be one of those, but had Leelites as well, and we even had rockets as well at one time. So we now had a really efficient aircraft and radar which could find U-boats and could attack them.
Were you still operating in the Western approaches?
Most of the time we had I was based at St. Ebel, and I suppose our basic, which is why we were armed to the teeth perhaps, our basic patrol was across the Bay of Biscay. I don't know how much you know about the U-boat war, but we attempted to bottle them up. Someone likened it very much to a tree. The roots were in about 5 different places. Saint-Nazaire, or Saint-Police, Brest, Lorient, and they came out into a funnel which went across the Bay of Biscay. Then it spread out, you know, like the branches of a tree in the Atlantic. So if we could catch them in the Bay of Biscay, then we had them, you know, where we wanted them, and in the most concentrated numbers. So we went up and down the Bay of Biscay in non-stop patrols, so arranged that one patrol behind the other was within radar range of the U-boats. So in theory, a U-boat couldn't get through the Bay of Biscay without being caught by the radar of either one aircraft or the next one following. It required very accurate navigation. We had this line of liberators going up and down the Bay of Biscay. But that was for our daytime and nighttime too. We both did day and night patrols up and down the Bay of Biscay. And the other was, we would send aircraft on detachment to Ballykelly in Northern Ireland, which would go out to escort convoys coming in, from Halifax.
Did you actually sink any U-boats?
I wish I had. I think I attacked about 6, but as far as I know, I never sank any. In fact, I know I didn't, because I've checked this up post-war. The one I straddled, and I know I straddled it because I've read his log since, I read the log of the U-boat, the one I straddled, no depth charge went off, and I can't tell you why. But at least I put the fear of God into several. All my attacks were at night. They were all at night.
What did you think to the use of the Leelite?
I think it was great. You see, because this non-stop patrol over the Bay of Biscay forced the U-boats to cross the Bay of Biscay at night. Unless we had the U-boat, they would have got away with it at night. They would have got through at night. So they were now keeping underwater during daylight and coming up, charging their batteries and going at night. So without the Leelite, they would have had a big window when they could have got through the bay.
At what distance did you switch the Leelite on?
Well, this is rather an interesting story. The man who invented as you probably know, it's a wing commander Lee, a ground administration officer. That's why it's called the Leelite, because after wing commander Lee. And he had a theory that you put the Leelite on at 3/4 mile range, which is an excellent theory, except you've got too many movables. You've got a wind, you've got an aircraft speed, you've got a U-boat which is moving in one direction or the other. And in theory, you could put the Leelite on at 3/4 mile, but you were unlikely to find the U-boat. So you had to swing it around until you did find the U-boat. You know, with luck, you could find the wash or something. Well, with extreme luck, you could actually put it on the U-boat. So the first night attack I made, there again, we still had sea returns, blotting out the last mile or two, but not anything like the extent. We still had the Atlantic rollers to compete with. So the first night attack I made, I was going on Wing Commander Lee's theory, and when it got down to what the radar operator said was a mile or three quarters of a mile, I put on the Lee light, and it just illuminated a chunk of sea. And there was a chap in the nose with handlebars like a motorcycle, who could move his light around, you see. So he was moving it round, but even before he moved it round, a stream of tracer came, actually from my side, from the port side, a stream of tracer came hurtling my direction. Well, now, of course, I knew where the U-boat was. We all knew where the U-boat was, because that's where the tracer was coming from. So all Wells and the nose had to do was swing the Lee light round, and there was the U-boat. And now, of course, all we had to do was to fly down the tracer. And when it got about half a mile away from the U-boat, all firing ceased. And there was the U-boat, and no fire coming up at all. And we were able to attack it. Obviously, we didn't drop the depth charges where we should have dropped. But when we got back, I thought about this. I'd spent an awful lot of time in intelligence. I was a flight commander of 53 Squadron. There was a rival flight commander of 224 Squadron, a marvellous New Zealand called Mick Ensor, the second best, most successful U-boat pilot of the war, Mick Ensor. And Mick and I used to spend hours and hours in intelligence. And we could practically build a U-boat if we knew so much about them. And one of the things we knew was they hadn't got belted-up ammunition. They only had drums. We also knew that they were using ammunition which was only lethal up to about 1,000 yards. After that, it wasn't lethal. So putting all this together, it suddenly occurred to me what was happening. A U-boat is a single light source. A single light source. You can't tell if it's quarter of a mile or 5 miles. Two light sources will give you some idea of range. So because Ware, who happened to be on the radar, a chap called Sergeant Ware, had given me a mile and three quarters, he'd misread the scale. I put it on. Once it's on, of course, they fired at it. And by the time I was in their lethal range, they were changing the drums. So I thought this was the right thing to do. And this is what I always did afterwards. I put it on about a mile and a half, mile and three quarters, let them fire at it. That told you where they were. You homed down. And when you got close, all the firing ceased because he'd used up his drums. And it's not easy to change a drum on board a tossing U-boat when you've got a 2 million candle power light shining in your eye, and at least half your attention is on your ear waiting for the klaxon, which says dive, because they left many a gunner as another thing, so Mick and I had found out. They dive so swiftly that they'd left many a gunner in the sea. So I never got a shot in the aircraft. In fact, I was sent for by Coastal Command to explain why I was, what my tactics were, and I got into quite a furious argument with Wing Commander Lee, who was saying, you should put it on the three quarters of a mile, and I explained why it was very, very unlikely to illuminate a U-boat straight away. It was far better to put it on about a mile and three quarters and let them run out of ammunition over the time you wanted to attack.
What counter-argument did he put against that?
Well, I don't... But he did put a counter-argument. I can't recall. He did put a counter-argument. Just asked, I was just told I was using it incorrectly. And I said, well, it works.
Did he say it gave them more chance to submerge?
Probably. But if they're firing at you, of course, they're not going to submerge. They're going to, they're going to try to get, the chaps below.
So this was the actual Lee who invented the Lee lights?
Yes,
that
yes.
You had the argument?
Oh, yes.
What kind of a chap was he?
Elderly. Well, not be my uncle, He was a wing commander, admin chap.
Was he ferocious?
No. I speaking off the record now, I think he was quite pleased that the light was being named after him. After all, he wasn't an operational chap. He was a wing commander admin chap who had this idea. Because at the time, I think they had another idea of a light, which or some flare thing, which didn't work. But the Lee light had its drawbacks. For one thing, it was out on the starboard wingtip, underneath the starboard, way out on the starboard wing of the Liberator. And you had to take off with almost maximum aileron trim on, to counteract the drag on one side. Another thing, it had 600 pounds weight of batteries, 2 million candle power. So 600 pounds weight of batteries you were lugging around. And you could jettison the Lee light. Fortunately, I mean, if you lost an engine on takeout, on takeoff, especially, the critical one, the faster you get in that Lee light, the better it was. You're taking off with a full aileron trim on there. You've got no more aileron trim left.
Which of the three basic periods in the war that you spent did you like best? The first U-boat, Malta, or the second U-boat period?
Well, it definitely wasn't the first U-boat period, because I was very junior and very unsuccessful. I naturally liked being a flight commander and having a decent aircraft. I suppose I liked probably the second period best. But by far the most memorable is Malta. I'm in Malta. I was nothing when I went to Malta, and I was put in charge of a unit, and I found myself talking to naval captains and AOCs. But it was, as David Beatty said, it was unreal. One was orderly and pleasant, and the other was just freak, but infinitely more memorable. No one who's ever in Malta will ever forget it.